Morning, everybody. Oh, that's loud. It was loud here, and I'm behind the loudspeaker, so I must... How are you all? Looking around. Yeah, some of you are not sure. So we've got the next in our series that we're doing, which will sort of follow through to the end of May, actually, on really what it means to be a follower of Jesus Christ. What does it mean to be a disciple of Jesus? And looking particularly at the specific things that Jesus said to those that followed him in the first century and trying to work out why they were so important and what they mean to us today. And we've got to thinking this morning about the way of humility. Humility as a marker of being a Christian disciple. I wonder what comes to mind when you hear the word humility. Is it a positive word, negative word, neutral word, acceptable word? Jesus talks about humility in a little story which we'll read just now, a very couple of verses from Matthew 18. About that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Who is greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" Jesus called a little child to him and put the child among them. Then he said, "I tell you the truth, unless you turn from your sins and become like little children, you will never get into the kingdom of heaven. So anyone who becomes as humble as this little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." And there Jesus flags up this kind of non-negotiable trait of humility as an indispensable character trait, as it were, for getting into the kingdom of heaven. Anyone who becomes as humble as this little child becomes the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And humility, of course, is really to do with ourselves, how we think of ourselves, who we think ourselves to be, and how we conduct ourselves in front of other people. And I want to think about what it means to be myself, not David Lawrence, but what it means for us to be a self, to be a person this morning. And I want to start by thinking that the stories that we're told about what self is all about. Who am I? What are my rights? What's my place in the world? And we lived in a world where, in a part of the world, the West, where self has been made central and everything else has been made marginal. I, as an individual, have been taught and trained to believe I've got inalienable rights to be an individual. I've been trained from a very early age, as have you, if you've grown up in this part of the world, to think of self, to myself, as being a very central character in the story of the world. Our culture has been, our culture is just the things that happen around us, the way that things are, and it's kind of an invisible force field that helps us think about ourselves in a certain way. We've been trained to think of our place in the world since we were born. We've been molded, if you like, by our culture to think about ourselves and the individual that is me in certain ways. The Bible wouldn't say, don't let the world around you squeeze you into its own mold if it were not possible for that to happen. It's quite possible for us to be molded by our culture, by the way things are in the world that we grow up and live in. And in our part of the world, for all sorts of interesting reasons that go right back to the Greek philosophers of the sort of 3 and 4th century BC, we've been growing up in a culture which puts self and individualism at the heart of the way the world is and the way the world works. It's a uniquely Western problem. The Chinese language doesn't have a word for individualism. There's a kind of word which translates roughly, and it translates as selfishness. Japanese and Korean don't have a language for individualism. The translation of human being from Japanese and Korean is human betweening. In other words, I am who I am in relationship to others. The idea of being an individual who's kind of autonomous and self-contained is a uniquely Western issue. And I've been dipping into this little book recently, not because of this talk, but just because I was dipping into it, called Selfie, How the West Became Self-Obsessed. And it looks at the way that it's not a Christian book, he's not a Christian author, but he's doing a bit of cultural analysis of the way that the Western world is so obsessed with individualism. And of course, the problem is that our world sets up ways to be human that are unattainable. That's the problem. The problem is that we're told what an ideal human being looks like through media, through advertising, through education, through images. We're told what an ideal human being looks like. This is, there's lots of words on the screen, I apologize for that, but this is the way he paints in this book, the Western self. He says, broadly, the ideal Western self is usually depicted as an extroverted, slim, beautiful, individualistic, optimistic, hardworking, socially aware, yet high self-esteeming global citizen with entrepreneurial guile and a selfie camera. It enjoys thinking that in some ways it's unique, that it's trying to make the world a better place, and one of the traits it will value highly is personal authenticity, or being real. It will preach that in order to find happiness and success, you must be true to yourself and follow your dreams. And if you dream big enough, you'll find that anything is possible. Now, that's his kind of caricature of the way that culture paints the ideal person, the ideal self. But he asks, or he makes the point, he goes on to say, because of its ubiquity, it's all over the place in our culture, we can lose sight of just how odd this view of personhood really is. It's a uniquely modern 21st century Western, or 20th century Western, phenomenon. Most people around the world and through history have not thought that individuals are like that. So the challenge is, what if we've grown up being trained by every fiber of culture's power to think of ourselves in ways that are just wrong? What if our culture has told us lies about what it means to be a self, to be a person? That would be terrible, wouldn't it? That would put all kinds of pressure on us to try and achieve something that's actually unachievable, even though everything's screaming at us, this is the way to be. That would make us neurotic. That would make us desperate. That would make us depressed. That would make us, like many of us are today, despairing of ever matching up to this ideal that's been painted of a true self. So, what if there's another way of being a self? I want to think about the Jesus self for a moment. How did Jesus think of himself? Do those words on the screen just now bear any relation at all to the way that Jesus thought of himself? How did Jesus define selfhood? Well, the image already points in a different direction to the one that I had on the screen earlier. The image of being here to serve others. It says in Philippians, doesn't it? You must have exactly the same attitude that Jesus Christ had. This is the attitude of a Christian self. Though he was God, he did not think of equality with God as something to cling to. Instead, he gave up his divine privileges. He took the humble position of a slave and was born as a human being. And when he appeared in human form, already humbled, what did he do? He humbled himself in obedience to God and died a criminal's death on a cross. Those words describe Jesus' self-perception, the humble man, the one who could have it all and did have it all, but who chose to live as a self who did not cling on to those aspirations and ambitions to be what often we're told we could be if only we follow the dream inside of ourselves. It's a nonsense, isn't it? The dream inside yourself, you can be whatever you want to be, it's a nonsense. And yet, it's sold all over the place in our culture, through TV programs, and, you know, just dream your dream, dream your biggest dream. I used to dream of being England's left back. I was never going to make it. I was too fat. I wasn't good enough at football. My knees creaked. It's just never going to happen, you know. I used to dream about being a great, I'd love to have been a rock drummer in a rock band. But I'm just not coordinated enough. I just could never do it. That's my dream. So you would say to me, if you were kind of living this kind of Western philosophy, if you can be whatever you want to be, just do it. Work harder, work harder. You can work as hard as you want to, but if you're not gifted that way, you'll never make it. You sell people a lie, and they will exhaust themselves and become frustrated at pursuing a dream that's just unachievable. Jesus came and he didn't live the dream, God life. He chose a selfhood which was defined by humility, by serving others. If you read through John's Gospel, you'll find in particular, you'll find a number of things that Jesus did not do or did not think of himself as. I just picked out three. Jesus had no personal ambition. Jesus said, I tell you the truth, the Son can do nothing by himself. He does only what he sees the Father doing. Whatever the Father does, the Son does also. Jesus had no personal ambition except for to do what God had called him to do. He had no dreams outside of that, no self-dreams. His self-dream was to honor his Father in heaven. He had no personal ambition, therefore he could never be frustrated. He had no need for approval. In John 5, we read, your approval means nothing to me, he said to the crowds. What a releasing thing that is. What a freeing thing to be able to look around and not in a kind of a put your fist up and say, I don't care what you think. It's not that attitude at all. It's much more, I know where my approval comes from. And because I know my Father in heaven loves me absolutely, I don't really need anything from you at all. That is a very liberating place to be. So if you know your Father in heaven is going to only call you to do what you can do, you don't have any personal ambition, but to do what he's gifted you to do. If you know your Father in heaven loves you completely, you don't need to seek the approval of others and be worried about what they think of you. And thirdly, Jesus had no need for adulation. He said, I have no wish to glorify myself. God is going to glorify me. He's the true judge. I don't need to achieve. I don't need to do anything at all which is going to bring praise to myself. Now, those are the marks of a humble person. But can you see that humility is rooted in our knowledge of God's relationship to us? I can be humble. I can not want anything from other people. I can not need to achieve anything other than what God is calling me to do because my relationship with God is such that I know he loves me and I know he'll only ask me to do what he's gifted me to do. And if, as our culture has tended to do, we cut God out of the equation, then we only have ourselves and we have no higher being who says, I love you. You're worth everything to me. We have to find that love and that worth somewhere else. We have to seek to be, to achieve, to own, to dominate. So the Christian self is rooted in the self-identity of Jesus, the self-understanding of Jesus, the man. The Christian self has been defined as the displacement of self by the enthronement of God. Andrew Murray is a South African pastor and writer at the late 19th century, early 20th century. And that's his definition of humility. Humility is the displacement of self by the enthronement of God. The only thing I care about is making God happy. The only audience I care about is playing before God my Father. The only love I need is the love of God my Father. I myself don't have to be seeking those things because they're already given. It's not, though, C.S. Lewis famously said, humility is not thinking less of yourself. It's not putting yourself down. It's not saying, oh, I'm such a miserable person. I'm so awful at everything. Lewis says it's not thinking less of yourself, but thinking of yourself less, which is a helpful way of putting it. So humility can be heard as a negative thing if we're not careful, that we always have to say, oh, I'm rubbish, I'm so bad at this and that and the other, and no, please don't thank me for anything. It's not that, but you just think of yourself less, not less of yourself. So what are the roots for Christian humility? Well, at least three. One is that as a human self, as a Christian, you remember that you're a created being. That your very life is dependent on something outside of yourself. You did not self-generate, nor were you simply generated by your parents. But as Christians, you believe that actually you are the creation of a creator. That in itself is a call for humility. I'm not God. Whoa, what a relief. I'm not responsible for anything, really, apart from keeping in touch with God. How wonderfully liberating is that? I'm a created being, and I'm a created being. I'm part of creation, and I'm a created being who is loved. I'm created into God's love and by God's love. That calls forth humility. But I remember also that I'm a flawed human being. I creak, I groan, I get things wrong. I carry the bruises of my upbringing. There are things that I've not been able to shake off yet. I'm created, yes, but I'm not perfect. And how liberated is it to know that I'm not perfect? That's what our culture wants us to be. It wants us to be this perfect individual that I described on the screen earlier. But how many of us have made it yet? Put up your hands. It can't be done, can it? There's another little, just want to read this little bit from this book again. It says, the stories of our tribe, our culture, insidiously persuade us that there's an ideal form of self and then define it for us. We internalize this story and this hero. We make our tribe's story our story. We spread it around in our gossip and storytelling, becoming unconsciously complicit in the conspiracy. And then we try to become this hero, forcing ourselves into its shape in the gym, in the office, on the therapist's couch. And all too often, guess what? We fail. When the plots of our lives stall, when they fall seriously short of standards and expectations, and we can't see a way back to feeling heroic, then dangerous perfectionistic thinking can be triggered. We decide that we're losers at this life game. We feel self-loathing. We might even find ourselves contributing to the already terrible statistics on suicide, self-harm, and eating disorder. But what these stories don't tell us is that it's all a lie. None of us are heroes. Not really. We're just us. We're just us. And if we'll only stop and appreciate the fact that we are created, yes, but we're also flawed, and that's okay. God can handle, as we've often said, cracked pots. That's the only sort there are. But we also remember that as Christian people, we are being renewed in the image of someone else. We're not being just made in the image of our upbringing, but we're being remade. We've been replanted, repotted. The gardening metaphor. We've been repotted in a different nurturing soil called Jesus Christ. And he, the humble one, is now the nutrient on which our lives are being fed. We are transplanted into Jesus Christ and being renewed in his image. Humility, thinking of ourselves less and thinking of God more. Displacing self and letting God have the ascendancy in our lives. It's not becoming a doormat for other people. It's becoming a servant of the King of Kings. And there's great freedom in a humble life. There really is. Great freedom in a humble life. Mother Teresa put it this way. If you're humble, nothing will touch you. Neither praise nor disgrace. Because you know what you are. Because you know what you are. A child of God, loved by him. Secure in him. So do you want to be a great disciple? Do you want to be the best disciple there is? Do you want to be greatest in the kingdom of heaven? So become humble like a little child. Start thinking realistically about yourself and reposition yourself under God's self and let his life flow through you.